Where I make wine, I like to push the limits of where grapes ripen.
People just need to trust their own palate and not be concerned about what a critic says or what they read in the paper.
As a master sommelier, I mean, for me, at this point in my life, I'm kind of more in the Yoda stage.
My dad used to say when I was a little kid that the best wine you'll ever have is one you want to have another glass of.
I had a moment when I realized the power of wine. One day at a dinner, a bottle of Mouton Rothschild 1955 was opened and it just like silenced the whole table.
I'm so happy when a friend of mine sells a bottle of wine. And I love to brag about the wines that are being made by our friends because I'm so proud of them.
Farming is agricultural warfare.
I can't imagine doing anything else.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 167.
And this week, we feature a rebroadcast of our 2009 podcast with Doug Nall of Nall Winery in Sonoma. We are running this interview exactly as it was cut back in 2009, so the reference to Lee and Andrew Nall will be inaccurate. For my two cents, this was definitely one of the most enjoyable interviews I've done. 1 year ago, we interviewed Lee Nall and her son Andrew from Nall Wines in Healdsburg, California. But there was one name that kept popping up during that interview, and that name was Doug, baseball fan, well-respected Sonoma winemaker, and Lee's husband. After a couple of years of trying to catch Doug at home, we finally cornered him for a long-awaited interview. We laughed, we talked about baseball, but most importantly, we got to look into Doug's world, where he makes some excellent wine. Wine, in fact, that makes you smart. We're back with Doug Nall. Finally, we've got him here in the flesh.
I can't do that.
You know, you can do that. I have no problem with that at all. We got to have a little humor in this thing. So, Doug, what have you been doing? What's going on?
Well, you know, we just sit there and watch the grapes grow and don't do much. Sort of like watching bourbon age in the barrels. I wish. It just seems like the business is as competitive as it's ever been. The most competitive. Which gets you up in the morning knowing that every week you turn around, there's another two or three more wineries popping up, and that will motivate one to make sure that their marketing eggs are spread around appropriately. So we spend a lot of time making sure that accounts are getting the wine. Of course we work on wine quality, but those are surge moments where you'll concentrate for 3 or 4 days on a blend, obviously crush, which is most of September and October. But beyond that, which of course when everybody thinks, well, this winemaking business must be easy, you just work 2 months out of the year, yeah, piece of cake, then it turns into a marketing game. So that's what we're doing right now. And we're getting ready for our 25 years of in business party in about 4 weeks. It is pretty amazing, huh? How somebody with the original ADD can stay in business for 25 years, but I've had a lot of help.
So are you still traveling a lot?
Not always for business, no. We try and pick our spots. Lee and I went to New Zealand in February. Got to know a lot of wineries, actually. I mean, so it was a little bit of business in that sense. We used to go to Europe once a year, and we have distributors in Europe, and we make a point of seeing them, if for 10 minutes, but I mean, at least a couple of days. You spend some time with the distributors, and we both like to travel, especially when it's wine areas. That's the best.
Last couple trips in, we did a couple interviews up here, and your name kept coming up, specifically when we talked alcohol levels, because of your philosophy. So tell me about that, if you would.
I can't hold my liquor, so I gotta... yeah. Well, there's no question that the paradigm of table wine has shifted upward, alcohol-wise. And since I'm about ready to do my 37th harvest... If you don't count my bathtub strawberry wine, then it would be 38. And I still maintain that at least 1,000 years of European winemaking style, where when we didn't know anything about microbiology and yeast choices, wine came out somewhere between 10 and 14% alcohol on its own. Okay, not to say those were great wines. Most of the time, they probably weren't. But if grape juice is left to its own style, it will turn into wine generally between 10 and 14 alcohol. It's with all the tremendous advances in microbiology that we've selected out lots of yeasts that have no problem fermenting to 15, 16, 17 alcohol. And viticulture has changed too, where there's lots more interest in having all the fruit as the same ripeness as possible at the same moment, and it's done with trellising and fertigation, meaning fertilizers through the drip lines. Drip, period, but also some fertigation. All of these things that are ostensibly making the wines cleaner and more disease-free should make better fruit that should make better wine. I'm not the only one, but several of us are waving the caution flag saying maybe we're making these vines a little too happy, and when one gets the sugars to classic table wine alcohol levels, there's no flavor in the grapes because the grapes are so happy, they're still photosynthesizing, they're just cranking away, and since there's no rain here at that point, usually in by the middle of September, we just keep letting them get riper and riper because they need to get riper and riper to have the flavors that they used to have at lower sugars, ergo lower alcohols. So that makes me old guard or old style, but I keep thinking they've been doing it for 1,000 years. So when was the first vineyard planted in Burgundy? About 875. I could be off of a couple of decades, but it was Charlemagne. And then Louis Pasteur figured out what actually was going on microbiologically, but it really wasn't until the last 30 years ago that we started nailing things like malolactic fermentation down and all these different yeasts that were out there. So I still maintain that somewhere between red wine, somewhere between 12.5 and 14, maybe 14.5 in a real ripe year, is a very good alcohol range to produce wines that are ageable, that are balanced, that are appropriate with many different food styles. So I'm really happy in my own wine skin with those kinds of wines and producing those kinds of wines.
And Andrew was telling me when we interviewed last time that you've improved the kind of cork that you're using in the bottles.
We always are looking for the best corks, and we've just decided we're going to pay more and more for corks. And I've always thought we really were getting good corks, and yet there is another level you can go to. So we do a sensory evaluation. Most every winemaker does these days. But a cork is not a cork is not a cork. You definitely have to watch out. On the other side of that coin, the cork companies have been put on triple alert with screw caps, synthetic closures. They know they have competition. And to actually even still stay in business, they've been forced to watch their quality control. A nice little sidebar to using corks, and I think people are waking up to this, is the environmental side, the so-called green movement side, in that there's a far smaller carbon footprint with cork production and use versus screw caps and synthetic closures. So that's a feel-good thing. In the long run, you are going to get the most potential out of wine using a natural cork.
Somebody who drinks a lot of wine in their household and their family, how could they contribute to recycling cork?
We have they call it a natural food store. It's called Shelton's in Healdsburg. They collect corks. They've just made a point of letting everybody that walks in say, if you've got any corks, whether you're a consumer or a winery, bring them to us and we'll find the appropriate recycling venue. Also, our manufacturer of corks, Amarim, they're an hour's drive away, so I hate taking them to them. It's much easier to take them 10 minutes away to the Healdsburg depot. But it's beginning to happen. People are saying, sure, we'll recycle these things. And they can go into all kinds of things. They're not going to go back into wine corks, but there's flooring, there's shoes, to name two that I can think of right off the top.
You were talking about that Nahl Zinfandel being not a cocktail Zinfandel, but a dinner Zinfandel. A food in Zinfandel. Yeah. Explain that to me.
It's just a personal preference, really, Ray. I kind of rail when someone comes off as, this is the way it has to be. I mean, okay, it's one choice, but since I think I probably have more tradition on my side than the modern style of wine, I guess that's why I think I'm holier than thou. But let's make it clear that it's just an opinion. Okay. For me, wine and a meal are the horse and carriage. Other people, we have lots of people that come in here and say, you know, there's nothing better than coming home from work and sitting down and having a glass of wine. And they use it as their cocktail. God bless them. That's fine. A glass of champagne is probably the best thing for that, in my opinion. But as a red table wine, which is primarily what we do a tiny amount of Chardonnay, I'm always thinking, geez, this tastes pretty good on the first sip, but what would I like to have with it to eat? So that's just where I am in it all. I have to be careful not to say it's the only way, and it's not the best way, but I think it's the traditional way, and I'm very comfortable with that.
Is there any food in particular you would recommend with Zin, anything? You
know? Well, the way we make Zin, which is to say somewhere between 13.5, 14 alcohol, pretty good acidity, a more of a subtle oak profile because it's French oak versus American oak. American oak is a little more aggressive, I guess probably the best way to put it. It depends on how old the wine is. If it's young, like this 07 that we're passing around right now, I would do pasta and pesto and some grilled veggies because it's so fruity and lively that it would just sort of bounce off all the garlic and the pesto, and that'd be pretty cool. As the wines get older, because our wines really do hold up well, 6, 8, 10 years is no problem. In a good vintage, it'll go 15. Then you can start getting more subtle, and maybe you can do some. I always think of pork tenderloin as being with about a 6-year-old Nahl Zin, and there's all kinds of way to do pork tenderloin. So pork and Zinfandel, at least the way we do it, seems to be a pretty good marriage. Right. When you get them out 10 or 12 years old and they get on a little bit more Bordelais-like, then I guess I'm supposed to say lamb, but not a whole lot of lamb is consumed around here. I would try some lamb with it. If it's really lamb and not mutton, you know, if it's a real delicate kind of a lamb, then an old Nahl Zin, pretty tasty.
So let's talk specifically about Nahl Zinfandel.
Well, Zinfandel is a chameleon, at least with our style, meaning that it's pretty darn fruity when it first is released. We know that. It isn't jammy fruit. It's more lively. We call it Zinberry, cherry, blueberry, blackberry, boysenberry, but not jam-like. Strawberry, even. There's strawberry. More fresh fruit, though. And I compare that, in Europe anyway, to Cru Beaujolais, like a Morgon or a Beaujolais that's actually built to last 10 years, a Gamay, because it's Gamay. Okay. Then with 4 or 5 years on it, it starts to move into something that's a little more Tuscan-like, a little more of that, a little bit of the mahogany character of the Sangiovese. When it gets a little older, then it sort of seems more like Chateauneuf de Pop, right? And when it gets really old, then all bets are off and people go, what is this? Is this an old Bordeaux? Okay. Or sometimes an old Rioja, which a lot of the Bordelais moved into northern Spain and sort of built the Rioja district area there, and they make Bordeaux. So you really have to ask, well, how old is the wine, and then what does it remind you of? What do you think of?
And that comes back to what you're talking about, laying down your particular wines. You talked about the idea of, oh yeah, lay these down, absolutely. So how long have you gone with yours?
Well, we're having this party on the 28th of June, and anybody that wants to pony up $20 is welcome. You know, we're going to open every wine we've made since 1984. Okay, not a lot of them, because we don't have a lot of them. So it'll sort of be depending on when it gets done. And we can't open them all day, all long, 7-hour event. But we'll have some of those wines open during the day. I know the 84 is still sound because we just opened it 9 months ago for a foreign wine distributor. And Andrew and I both kind of held our breath going, well, this is going to be a little old. It's 24 years old. It was fine. It was just fine. So they don't fall off a cliff. They continue to be drinkable, whether they're better at 24 years than they were at 14 or 8. That's just where your palate is. If you've got that old claret, British, I like them old and mature palate, then those wines are very drinkable. If you like them a little fresher and fruitier, then you probably want to do them at about 6 to 8 years.
That would be a target then for something you've done over the last 10 years or so?
I'd say 4 to 8 would be good. Yep. The 04 is really coming into its own right now. The 05 is still a little tight, but that was the vintage. It's actually a great vintage, 05. For us, it was really, really good. But it hasn't really quite opened up yet. People say the 06 is tasting real good to them right now. It's probably still a little young. And then this puppy 07 that we're just trying right here. And they have to be stored right. You can't, as we joke around on our website, if it's on top of your refrigerator in the kitchen, don't call us. Well, I know it's a huge investment, the wine refrigerator, but at today's quality premium wine prices, it's a pretty good insurance policy to make sure that that $40, $50, $60, $100 bottle of wine you bought, you get the optimum potential out of it by putting it in if you don't have an underground cave, you know.
Which few of us have.
Or you get your storm cellar, you know, if you're in Tornado Alley, maybe you do have your perfect storm cellar that would be ideal.
Anything else you want to talk about?
I just want to say thanks to my mom and... No. You've asked me the question that you felt were important, and I gave you my unabashed opinion, didn't I? Well, it's fun to do.
Thanks for doing it, Doug. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Ray.
You can learn more about Nahl Wines at nahlwinery.com. Be sure to check out the animated logo on the opening page. It's worth the trip.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2015.